This is the United States Dressage Federation's official podcast. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Chris Stafford. On this week's episode, we hear part two of the evolution of sport horse feeding with Dr. Joe Pagan, which was taken from an education session at the 2013 Adequan USDF Annual Convention. But first, our trainer's tip of the week comes from Charlotte Bradall, who offers advice on preparing for a show. Charlotte, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Well, the trainer's tip is very popular, and I know you've got some more great ideas to add for our listeners this week. So where would you like to start? Because I think they affect so many people, the ideas that you have.
Okay. Well, just a couple of weeks ago, I was entered in a show with two horses that really had very, very little show experience. One of them had no show experience, and the other one had, but a long time ago. So I really treated both of them like they had never been to a show. And one of the things that I believe very much in is actually practicing the test quite a bit. And I know a lot of people say, well, the horses will start anticipating, but you have to do it in a certain way where you have to change it up just a little bit. And for instance, coming into the halt, if you, let's say at any level, you're going to come down the center line to a halt, whether it's trot halt or canter halt. But instead of halting exactly at X, practice like you were going to halt at X, but then go maybe 10 more feet before you halt. And in the canter, where a horse really likes to sort of stop before X, and you want to just keep going and pretend like you're going to halt, but more like canter in place instead. And then maybe do that a couple of times before you actually do the halt. And then when you do the halt, don't do it at X, do it past X. And then go on from there. And then, for instance, let's say you do a lengthening across the diagonal or an extension. Let's say you have a horse that wants to brace or not come back at the end of the lengthening. Then practice a walk transition at the end. So the horse, before you come to the corner, already knows he's going to come back, and he'll wait for you a little bit and come back easier. Of course, with horses that want to slow down too soon, you want to really ride him way into the corner before you come back. So it kind of depends on what the horse does and how he anticipates. All the lateral work, you don't have to worry about the horses anticipating between shoulder and haunches in and 10-meter circles and stuff. That's really not a problem. When it comes to flying changes, especially early on, you do have a good chance that the horse will be anticipating. And so there, you want to make sure you don't do the change exactly where it's prescribed when you're practicing a test. And let's say you're doing a half pass from the center line to the rail, which is in both third and fourth level, then do not do the change right after the half pass. Because if you practice it that way, then chances are you're not going to have a really good half pass because the horse is already going to be thinking flying change. So you're just going to keep going in counter canter and then do the flying change much later. And you're just going to stay in counter canter as long as it takes for the horse to relax and wait for you to give them the aid for the change. And if you always practice it like that, then when you're actually in the ring and doing it where you're supposed to, the horse is not going to be anticipating and you can get a nice relaxed change most of the time. Another area where a horse will almost always anticipate the flying change is if you're going across the diagonal in an extended canter and you have to come back at the end, there's a change at the end. So I do the same thing there. If I practice Pre-St. George or I-1, instead of doing the change there, I practice extended canter and then really collecting the horse as much as I possibly can, but then don't do a change. So the horse is, instead of anticipating the flying change, he'll anticipate that you're really going to collect him. And I shouldn't be speaking from a judge, but a lot of times when you see people riding that, you'll see a horse throwing in the flying change too early or not coming back at all before the flying change, no collection. But if you always practice that you're going to really collect them there and not doing a flying change until after you go through the corner, they won't anticipate, and you'll be able to really bring them back and then show a nice straight flying change before the corner. There are so many other places but mostly in the flying change is where the horses anticipate the most, I think. So again, with all the lateral work, you don't really have to worry about it, and you can ride through it just like it is in the test. And if you have a horse that anticipates an extended trot, if you have a horse that's really strong, then don't start going until you get, for instance, 2X. So if that's a problem, then you just make the horses wait. And where the tempi changes are in the higher levels, if you have a horse that kind of takes over in them, then don't count when you go across like it is in the test. Then do maybe one change and then really collect the horse and make the horse wait, and then do another change and then make the horse wait before you do another one. So you don't get concerned with counting at all when you're practicing. And then when you do the actual count, maybe do it not as part of practicing the test. But other than that, I think you can really practice the majority of the test without any problems except for those points. Pirouettes, they will also sometimes anticipate sort of how they can get out of doing them. So what I'll do sometimes is, let's say I'm practicing right now, I have a horse I'm showing I won. So at home, when I come across the short diagonal to get ready for the pirouette, instead of actually turning there where it's supposed to be, I just do some really, really collected steps, all the things I would do to prepare for the pirouette, but not necessarily do the pirouette. And then at other times, instead of doing a full pirouette there on that short diagonal, I'll do a half a pirouette and then go on a few steps before I do the second half, because the horses can very quickly learn to kind of throw themselves around in the pirouette. So if you practice full pirouettes often, chances are you're going to have some problems in the test. And even at Grand Prix level, coming down the center line, I would not practice the full pirouettes. I practice usually two half pirouettes. And that makes them sort of wait for you in the middle and makes it a lot more rideable than when the horse knows it's going to go all the way around every time. So a lot of those things, you can make it so the horse is much more rideable in the show ring because he's not anticipating in those spots. But I do think it's very important to ride through the test quite a bit before the show. I think it gives the horses and the riders confidence that they know where they're going, and it's all work that they can very comfortably do. If you can't do it very comfortably at home, then you shouldn't be showing at that level, and then you need to look at showing at a lower level. Because if you can't do it well at home, for sure it's not going to get better in the show ring. So that doesn't make sense. And if you show at a level where the horse is not quite ready, then the horse will lose its confidence in the rider very quickly. So that doesn't really make any sense to do that. Another thing that I've done, like with these two horses that I'm going to be showing here pretty quick, is trying to get them used to a little bit of show atmosphere. I have one horse of the two I'm showing. He can be quite spooky even at home. And so I've been setting up all sorts of things, scary things around the arena. I'm not so scary. But for instance, I wrapped a chair in tarp and put it at sea. And things like that. And you'd be amazed of how many horses will spook at that. Even the shows in this season, show horses, even some of my other horses would spook at that. I put up flowers on top of things and then found little reflectors that I put in that the sun would catch and then it would start spinning. I mean, kind of scary things. And then I put the sound system out there and played music and even had a PA system out there, because that's another thing. Horses can be used to music and it's no problem at all. And then when suddenly somebody talks at a PA system or they drop the mic or something like that, that could be really scary for a horse. And actually with two of my horses that I knew were going to be more reactive to the sound, instead of actually being on them when I put started the PA system, I actually had him in the stalls and just started talking to them from the outside of the stalls. and then it was like no big deal. And then when I was on him the next day, it was not a big deal. So there are just lots and lots of things you can do. The other thing I also recommend to people, instead of just start showing, is just take your horses to neighbors' places, especially with young horses. Just take them around town wherever you can go and ride. And that way, if you have any problems, it's much less stressful to deal with, because you're not stressing about the show. You're not worrying about performing. You're just worrying about making it comfortable and secure for the horse. And so you're able to deal with problems much better. It's also good for the horses to go on little trailer rides like that where they're not going very far. So pretty soon they think it's no big deal to go places. I'm talking more about younger horses now. But I also think it's a good idea for not only for the horses, but also for less experienced riders, is to just go and ride a test for your friend or your neighbor or somebody, and then have somebody videotape you and then critique it yourself. Because, you know, most people, they may not be able to feel something, but they'll still be able to see it when you look at the video to some degree, and or have your trainer critique it. But I think it saves you a lot of money in the shooting if you do all of that in advance, and you're going to feel a lot more confident when you go to the show and feel really prepared.
Well,
do you have any questions on that, Chris?
Some great suggestions there, Charlotte. It's all about the preparation, isn't it? It's having a professional approach, even if you're an amateur.
Yeah, because it makes the whole experience so much more fun and so much more, less stressful if you know you're not going to have to worry about so many of those things, and that you're used to going in and riding a test, and the horse is used to going different places, going through a test. Because otherwise showing can be, when you're first starting to show, can be really stressful, and it should be fun.
Exactly. We're meant to enjoy it as well, aren't we, without all the stress that's going on. As you say, you desensitize them as much as you can at home and in other environments, so that when you get to the show, you can focus on the class and on your riding yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's my philosophy, and it certainly has paid off for me. I wish that I had done all of that with my Olympic horse a long time ago, because he was very, very spooky. But he wasn't really spooky at home, not so much. But I think if I had done a lot of the stuff at home, it would have been a lot easier, because I had some shows in the beginning where I couldn't even get in the ring because he was just afraid of everything. And even when it came to the Olympic trials, just as I was about to go in one of my tests, it started raining, and every person on the grounds opened up their umbrellas. That's kind of hard to prepare for, but but you can do things like that. It's just not things that you normally would think about. But
you can pretend that it's raining in California,
that's right,
and get your friends to come around with their umbrellas.
Yeah, I mean, you really can, but it's the kind of thing. I think that even happened to one of the Olympic riders in London. I'm not sure. I think it was umbrellas going up that totally ruined his ride, I'm pretty sure, and because of that, the whole team. So I think there's a lot of things you can do at home that makes them so that things don't upset them nearly as much if they've had a lot of exposure.
It's all in the preparation. Well, thank you very much indeed for that, Charlotte. Really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you. You're very welcome.
And now for part two of Evolution of Sport Horse Feeding with Dr. Joe Pagan. This segment was taken from an education session at the 2013 Adequan USDF Annual Convention. Dr. Pagan is the founder and president of Kentucky Equine Research.
So the question is, are there other types of equine behavior that are feed related? And this was a very important question to ask. What is the effect of feed on behavior? So back in the 90s, we did some tests where we looked at the effect of diet and exercise on the behavior of stabled horses. We took different feeds and we found feeds that had different glycemic responses. And a glycemic response is you feed a measured amount of feed and you measure blood glucose in the blood over time and you index that change in blood glucose to a standard. For us, we use a standard of oats as our standard, where that would be a glycemic index of 100. We found in this study that higher glycemic feeds affected behavior in some horses, but not in all horses. But because of this discovery that behavior was influenced by diet, diet started to change. Because now, when we're talking about modern sport horse nutrition, we're talking about a balancing act of athletic performance and behavior. So really what we've done is we've taken these feeds that were originally produced for medical uses and we've made them into sport feeds. So that is a big change that's occurred in terms of how we're formulating these feeds today. Now there are different octanes of feed that you can get. And I'm sure that when you go and visit your feed store and you look at everything on the internet, you're confused as hell about what all of this means, because it is quite confusing about what octane do you need and what's correct for an individual type of horse. Basically, we've done the same sort of thing in developing different types of sport horse feeds by manipulating the energy sources that are needed by changing the amount of non-structural carbohydrate and fat so that we're delivering the same number of calories, but we're delivering them from different sources, so that now you have a range of different types of feeds that can be used that deliver energy from different energy sources. And basically what we've done is we've taken a very wide range of non-structural carbohydrate content. So we have feeds that are reasonably high in NSC, but these feeds that we would feed to racehorses are in the neighborhood of about 35% non-structural carbohydrate. Sport horse feeds, 25 to 28, and then the so-called fat and fiber feeds, the ones that we've taken a lot of the carbohydrate out and we've substituted fat and fiber, they're down only at about 14 to 18% NSC. This is not as low as that medical feed. This is one step up the ladder, but it's still very low. To keep the number of calories the same, as we take the sugar away, we have to add other sources of calories, and we do that by adding more fat. These fat and fiber feeds are up in the 10 to 12% range, where racehorse feeds are more down in the 6% range, and we increase the fiber as well. Remember, though, when you're looking at the fiber content of a feed, you can add super fiber, beet pulp, soy hulls, and you can add inert fiber like rice hulls or peanut hulls. Rice bran's a different thing. Rice hulls is the shiny stuff that you use for bedding. That it's fiber. You would measure it as neutral detergent fiber, but the horse can't ferment it at all. So what we've done is we've used the super fibers to add a lot of the different types of calories. This is an American phenomena, really, in terms of the way that we've gone so far from the high carbohydrate to the high fat, high fiber. And the reason we know that is that we deal with a lot of international horses. One of the jobs that KER has, I should say it's a hobby, because the definition of a hobby is something you don't make money at. Well, it's like owning dressage horses, I think. We've been the official feed supplier for the last five Olympic Games. and we get hired by whatever the Olympic Committee is to come and provide the feed, the hay, and the bedding for the horses that are going to perform at the games. So we have a lot of interaction with the international community with these sports. In 2010, when they had the World Equestrian Games here in Lexington, because of our experience doing that before, the WEG folks hired us to provide the same service here for WEG. And so one of the things that we did there was we helped all of the teams import their different types of feeds in for competition. We also provided some that we made here as well. But in all, we helped import over 140 different brands of horse feed from Europe. We had it all consolidated in a shipping container in Belgium, and we brought all of these feeds over. So we had access to this huge number of different types of feeds that were used by the most elite horses in all of these WEG disciplines, and we took that opportunity to analyze all of them to see what were they and how did they compare with what we do here. So these European feeds are still quite high in non-structural carbohydrate. If you look at fat content, most of those feeds were not high in fat. So again, if you look at our fat and fiber, the feeds that we've been feeding in the U.S. to sport horses, they are atypical compared to what's being used internationally, at least at this elite level. And then neutral detergent fiber, again, we're adding more fiber to our feeds here than these international horses. Now, it'll be interesting to you, because we were delivering all these, we knew what discipline they went to also. They housed at WEG. This was sort of a deviation from what they do at the Olympics. They housed all the horses by discipline rather than by country. Usually they house by country and they mix in the different disciplines. Here I think they decided that one discipline, which won't be named at this, they were worried would be cheating too much. So they put them all in the same section where they could keep a closer eye on it. It wasn't dressage. We knew what disciplines each were using these different feeds. And when we looked at by discipline, what we did find that in terms of NSC, the dressage discipline, they tended to have the lowest percentage of NSC. But still, the mean there is over 30%. So they were still pretty high. And they also had the highest fat content of any of them. So even in these international dressage horses, they were using more fat and less NRC, but the Europeans have not gone nearly to that degree that we've gone in the U.S. So what should you feed? That becomes the dilemma. What is the best type of this mixture of these different energy sources should you use? Well, for one thing, it depends on exercise intensity. The faster a horse goes, the more it depends on muscle glycogen. And the more it depends on muscle glycogen, the higher NSC it needs. So at the top of the heap is the racehorse. If you tried to train a racehorse on a fat and fiber feed, it would run out of gas. It would eventually not be able to have enough muscle glycogen. Because horses can, because you can train a horse's muscle to burn fat, then these high fat and fiber feeds are natural for endurance horses. So they're higher in fat. So as exercise intensity increases, the amount of sugar increases and fat decreases. As exercise duration increases, just the opposite occurs. The problem with using blood glucose and muscle glycogen is that there's a finite supply, and eventually the muscle will run out if you exercise long enough. So for the really long exercise duration, having more fat, training the muscle to use less carbohydrate, spares that carbohydrate and allows the horse to exercise longer. Well, what about behavior? And this is probably where is the dressage question. What do you do about behavior? In general, the less non-structural carbohydrate, the less effect it has on behavior. And so a lot of dressage horses utilize diets that are higher in fat, lower in non-structural carbohydrate, higher in fermentable fiber. Now, this does not hold true for every horse. There's a lot of horses that are completely unaffected by the concentration of non-structural carbohydrate. They do fine. It doesn't bother them at all. For those types of horses, this isn't necessarily the best choice. There's a trade-off, and I think you need to realize this, when you go to extremes in terms of trying to manipulate this to affect behavior. Every single horse's muscle needs to use sugar to burn. It uses muscle glycogen to burn. And if you get to the point where you have no muscle glycogen, the horse isn't going to perform. So that's an important consideration. Again, muscle glycogen is an important fuel for horse muscle. We did an interesting study recently that we're going to present next summer at the International Conference on Equine Exercise Physiology, where we fed horses different concentrations of non-structural carbohydrate, fat, and fiber. We exercised the horses real hard. We measured the amount of muscle glycogen in their muscle by taking biopsies of the muscle, and we saw how well those horses could replete the muscle glycogen when they were fed these different mixtures of fuels. We did this with thoroughbred horses that were fed isocaloric rations, meaning the same number of calories, with either a high, a medium, or a low level of non-structural carbohydrate. The low level was pretty extreme. 23% of the calories were coming from fat, 45% from fiber, only 18% from NSC, where the high was more like a racehorse feed. We then performed standardized exercise tests to deplete muscle glycogen, and we took muscle biopsies at 0, 24, 48, and 72 hours after we depleted these horses. What we found was, when we fed a regular type of high non-structural carbohydrate diet and a moderate non-structural carbohydrate diet, the horses repleted their muscle glycogen and were back basically to where they began. When we fed the low starch diet, though, the low non-structural carbohydrate diet, they couldn't replete their muscle glycogen. So that brings to the next question of how much do you need for different types of disciplines? And I think that's going to be the next area of research. You would think intuitively a dressage horse wouldn't burn a lot of muscle glycogen during work. And that's true if you look at a whole muscle. The muscle has a lot of different types of muscle fibers, but there's some fibers that are fast twitch fibers. Those are the strength fibers that can only use muscle glycogen. And so if you have a dressage horse that is very dependent on those specific muscle fiber types, you may not be able to measure a decrease in total muscle glycogen, but there may be individual fibers that this is important. So I think the take-home message there is don't necessarily get carried away with getting rid of sugar, that sugar is toxic. Sugar isn't toxic. Horses' muscles do well by being fed these types of diets. I would say for your individual horse, titrate the amount of sugar and fat and fiber that's in an individual feed, and find one that you feel like the horse's behavior is not influenced. But if behavior isn't an issue, higher carbohydrate diets actually are quite good.
You can hear the concluding segment in this series on next week's episode. This podcast is available for download on iTunes. Remember to visit eTrack, the USDF's online learning center and resource for dressage and equine education at usdf.org. The USDF is your connection to the American dressage community.